Welcome to Outrage Overload, a science podcast about outrage and lowering the temperature. This is episode 25. In past episodes, we've explored research showing that Democrats and Republicans grossly overestimate how different they are from each other on major issues and how much they like or dislike each other. For example, a 2021 study by Pew Research Center found that Democrats and Republicans overestimated the percentage of people on the other side who hold extreme views on a range of issues, including abortion, gun control, and health care. These misperceptions can have harmful consequences for American democracy. When people believe that there is a larger gap between them and the other side than there actually is, they are more likely to support actions that benefit their own political party at the expense of the country. This can lead to political polarization, gridlock, a decline in civility, and even political violence. It is important to note that these outcomes are not inevitable. There is a strong interest in reducing support for political violence, anti-democratic attitudes, and partisan animosity among Americans. And that's what we're going to talk about on this episode of the Outrage Overload podcast. I'm your host, David Beckmeyer, and today we're speaking with a researcher at the forefront of a fascinating initiative known as the Strengthening Democracy Challenge, a joint project between academics and practitioners to crowdsource and identify short, scalable interventions to reduce anti-democratic attitudes, support for political violence, and/or partisan animosity among Americans.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jan Völkel. I'm a PhD student at Stanford University in the Polarization and Social Change Lab. I'm very interested in studying and understanding morality and political conflict. And most of my experimental work focuses on trying to reduce problematic attitudes or potentially problematic attitudes in the American mass public.
The SDC was launched in 2021 by a team of researchers at Stanford University, the University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Michigan. The challenge is funded by a variety of sources, including the National Science Foundation. We'll explore this groundbreaking challenge in depth, discussing the interventions tested, the reception they received, and the potential for positive change. Listen in to learn more about the challenge, its goals, and its potential to transform our democracy. All right, Jan, well, thank you very much for making time to come on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, I first saw this. Oh, yeah, you're welcome very much. I first saw this work that you're doing and thought, wow, how did I not know about this already? Because it seems to fit in very nicely with the kinds of things we talk about on the show. I've had on, you know, a couple of guests talking about civility. I've had some folks working in kind of in civil dialogue. I don't know if you're familiar with the Dignity Index effort going on, but I had a person from that effort on the show, and Tammy Pfeiffer, and we had a nice talk. And that's another kind of interesting project. And I saw what you're doing in it. And so I just wonder if you could tell our audience a bit about this effort that you're working in on the in particular the what was it? What's it called? The Strengthening Democracy Challenge, I think. And then there's a mega study associated with that. And so if you could tell us a little bit about that and even educate me on, you know, kind of what is a mega study and how does that work?
Yeah, it's a funny term, you know, like in times of like big data, like we, you know, it's a question of contention if we should call it a mega study or if that is too big of a term. Well, yeah, super excited. You know, like some of the previous guests that you have had on the show were actually part of the Strengthening Democracy Challenge as well. So Kurt Gray, Steve Ratier, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing all of the names correctly. I hope they will forgive me if I didn't. So the Strengthening Democracy Challenge was our attempt of trying to identify the best short and scalable online interventions for reducing a variety of attitudes in the mass public that might be problematic for democratic societies, such as, for example, support for undemocratic practices, so practices conducted by political elites that break with democratic norms. Another attitude that we tried to reduce was support for partisan violence. So, like, for example, supporting the usage of violence after the opposite party wins an election. Or, like, another attitude that was part of the challenge was partisan animosity, which is oftentimes defined as the tendency to dislike supporters of the opposing party. And the lab that I am a part of here at Stanford, the Polarization and Social Change Lab, has tried to work on these issues for quite some time. In particular, like, persuasion on attitudes, like trying to reduce polarization. But we thought that we had arrived at a time where the need for progress on especially reducing the anti-democratic attitudes seemed very urgent. So we thought that we no longer just want to spend the resources of with the lab on like testing our own ideas, but rather trying to collaborate with as many people in this field as possible to like test the best ideas that the field has to offer. And this field is really an interdisciplinary field in the sense that, like, we are sociologists, we have like social psychologists in the lab, there are plenty of political scientists who are working on this, communication scholars, economists, like people really from across the social sciences, and also practitioners who like are doing work on the ground, trying to bring people from the different sides together and try to reduce polarization and anti-democratic attitudes that way. And so we thought we would do a tournament where everyone, including academics, practitioners, and like whoever sees our call for submission can submit an idea, and then we would test however many ideas we would have the funding for. We ended up having funding for testing 25 ideas in one of the biggest social science online experiments of its kind. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. And so I want to jump get this one in here early because I want to kind of make sure we have some clarity on it. So, you know, I can already tell that some people are going to be kind of wondering what anti-democratic means in this context and feel like, well, does that mean you're only attacking people on the right, or does that mean you're only attacking somebody else? So tell us more about a little bit about how you're defining that. And because there's kind of a post-truth world we're in and kind of an anti-science world we're in. And I think people can react to that a little bit. So walk me through that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So we started with the basic insights, which is based on prior research that most people in the U.S. support democratic principles in abstract. So where it gets more tricky is when you ask it in a context of supporters of your own side doing something that is undemocratic, and then the question is like, to what extent do you tolerate that or not? So like we ask questions to participants depending on their partisan identification. So each of the participants identified as either Democrat or Republicans. We filtered out people who said that they were truly independent. They were not part of the study. And so if a participant identified as Democrat, we would ask then a series of questions such as Democrats should not accept results of elections that they have lost, or Democrats should reduce the number of polling stations in areas that support Republicans. And for Republican participants, they would read a parallel item, but the in-group would be switched. So a Republican participant would read, Republicans should reduce the number of polling stations in areas that support Democrats. So like we did not take a stand really in terms of like, asking it in a specific context where we say like the right is doing this more or the left is doing it more. It was really from the perspective of the participant, it was always supporters of one's own side engaging in undemocratic practices so that there would be a conflict where people had to decide, do they want to put party over democratic principles or do they want to put democratic principles over party?
Thank you. That's helpful. And then you would try like 25 different approaches to see if you could move people from their sort of starting position.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So like we had what we in the experimental research call a control condition, which basically provided us with baseline values of support for example, undemocratic practices or support for partisan violence or partisan animosity. And then after participants assigned to the 25 different interventions, we got these measures from them. And then we could compare whether participants who completed the intervention scored higher or lower compared to participants in the baseline condition.
And you were able to move, if I recall what I read, you were able to move people in many cases.
Yeah, that is correct. It very much depended on the kind of outcome. And, I think that this is very, very interesting in terms of like, this is a big field and many people have different kinds of priorities in terms of outcomes that they really care about, right? So like, some people may think, well, I just want to reduce the basic hostility that is there between like rank and file Republicans and Democrats, right? Which like may lead to a lot of problems in like groups of friends or in families, right? And for that, we found that people in the field really know how to reduce partisan animosity. So like out of the 25 interventions that we tested, 23 out of those 25 interventions reduce partisan animosity, in part quite by quite a lot, and so the most effective strategies were to highlight sympathetic exemplars of people who hold different political beliefs, but who are still came across as likable, reasonable people. And then another effective strategy was to highlight a common identity that the Democrats and Republicans shared. For example, one intervention used the national identity as Americans and said that Democrats and Republicans should embrace their joint identity as Americans and recognize that they share a lot of goals and principles are consistent with that identity.
Interesting. So to be honest with you, with all the research that I've looked at, I'm actually surprised that worked because it seems like our hostility has gotten so bad that superordinate identity as Americans seems to not be as strong.
Yeah. So like, I mean, one interesting takeaway from our study overall is that like the devil is oftentimes in the detail. So I love that you asked to dig deeper here. So like we found that like with these higher level strategies, it's like very much mattered in terms of like how they were employed. So I think that there was like a lot of research that like needs to be done to really understand when certain strategies work better or worse. So, like, for example, we found that the national identity worked well. There was another intervention that argued that many rank and file Republicans and Democrats share an economic identity and an economic interest, and we found that like that was one of the interventions that was not very effective across the board in terms of trying to unite Democrats and Republicans and move the needle. So yeah, it is like a question of using a strategy and then also implementing it in convincing matter, I would say.
So I'm curious, have you had, like, what's the feedback among other researchers and sort of the community at large? Are they starting to say, okay, well, because I hear, because I talk to a lot of these folks, I hear a lot of sort of doomsaying, like, yeah, none of this stuff works. So I'm curious if you've got some traction and people say, okay, this looks promising, maybe we can do something here.
Yeah, like, you know, I think overall the reception of the study has been very positive, both in terms of like the results being better than we also had a like forecasting tournament where we had like, you know, practitioners, academics, like trying to predict like which interventions would work, and I would say that like our study probably exceeded expectations there. So like that is exciting, and I think like the sense in particular that I got from the feedback that we received was that people think that this is exciting. There are tons of like mega studies or like these like big studies testing many different ideas at the same time happening that are modeled in part after the Strengthening Democracy Challenge. There's a climate change one that has already been concluded. We are planning a follow-up projects on this. So like I do think that like some optimism has spread. We also organized a conference last year where we brought practitioners and academics together, and there was a lot of optimism on the practitioner side who, you know, like I thought it was so great. We got like I think 56 submissions from practitioners, and we want to acknowledge like that like this is the environment, the testing environment we selected is our own area of expertise, right? Like that's what we do for breakfast, lunch and dinner. For like practitioners, this is not the way that they operate at all typically, right? So like we thought that it was great that so many practitioners out there were like willing to test their ideas in an environment that was like a bit different from like what they typically do. And our idea now is by like, you know, to go back more into the practitioner mode and see like after we have we have identified these insights from our study where a lot of things are very, very controlled so that we can make so that we can draw theoretical conclusions. We want to go back to the practitioner side and see, you know, can this actually work in the field as well? And I think like getting those insights in terms of like how translatable, how convertible are the insights that we get from these survey experiment kind of study to the field, that is going to be super exciting, right? Because like if it's not, or at least for a nerd like myself, like that.
Right.
So like, because if we do find that, you know, like our survey experimental results are helpful, now we have a model that we can follow in the future, right? From like going from the survey to the field. If it doesn't go well, you know, then I think we also learn that we need to run our studies a bit differently, because like at the end of the day, you know, we're interested in having impact in the real world. Yeah. So like, and I think, you know, like researchers are like to be like trained to be very, very critical of the work, but there's also an appreciation of like when things don't work, right? We still like learn a lot from that. We don't talk that much about the ideas that were submitted to the challenge that didn't produce effects. But I thought like some of those ideas were like fantastic ideas, you know, and it's good to know that at least in the context in which we tested them, they did not produce effects. Because now, like, you know, like if you want to design your own intervention, you don't have to go through that process. Or if you're still a big fan of that idea, you know, you can say, well, you just did it wrong, and so I'm going to show you how you have to do it slightly differently, and then it may work.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And it makes sense. So yeah, I'm super excited about this because, I mean, like I say, I usually get a lot of bad news and not a lot of hope. So this is great to have a project here that has demonstrated, you know, that some things work and you can reduce some of this animosity and potentially things that can lead to violence. So I think that's great to have some hope on that. And it sounds like just reaching out beyond academia is also, you know, as you say, to practitioners is also something that could be a good tool for scaling it up. Because like you say, there are quite a few organizations out there on the ground that do want to work on these kind of problems. So I think that's great. I mean, I could sort of chat about this all day, but I think we've probably run out of time today. So I really do appreciate you coming on the show, though, and I wanted to thank you again.
Yeah, thank you so much. Like, I really enjoyed talking to you about this. I think you put your fingers in exactly the right spots in terms of like the next steps that we need to work on. And I'm excited about going there.
Good, good, good. Awesome. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Bye, David.
Bye-bye. And now it's time for our Street Outrage segment. In today's segment, we hear from John.
People really need to take stock in how they react to things, because how they react is really a reflection on them. How they think about themselves, how they view the world, their own prejudices, their own, you know, and this is how I learned this. I learned this by, I used to become very uncomfortable and or upset whenever I would see obese people. And it took me a long time to make that connection that the reason I get so upset is because I was a fat kid. I was bullied. I have, you know, some degree of body dysmorphia about my body image. And so it's really about a reflection of how I view myself and how I feel unhealthy or maybe fat or don't look good in clothes or whatever it is. That's all on me. Has nothing to do with the people who are just minding their own business, right, Walking down the street, and I'm making this whole thing up in my head. That's me. And that's, you know, I have to call myself out on that. And I think more people need to take stock in why are they so outraged. I will tell you what I'm very disappointed in. And there are certain, you know, late night talk shows, comedy shows, and I'm not going to mention the ones, but there are some that are very, very politically leaning. And this is on a broadcast network, right? And, you know, they've taken on this banner of, we're right, and we're going to spend every night of our show not entertaining America, but we're going to be on this political agenda to, you know, instruct the American people on how they should think, how they should vote, how they should feel, because we know better. And that's what I get from it. They're telling me I'm a moron, I'm an idiot. We know better because we're here in New York City or in Hollywood, and we know more than you. We're more informed, more educated. We have a staff of brilliant writers. And so we're going to just, through using humor to soften a little bit, we're going to try and just, you know, spoon feeds you what you should know and what you should be thinking. And I just totally, you know, I do get outraged over that and I turn it off. Look, you know, whoever is the president is, we all get a laugh at the president's expense. We get a laugh out of their policy mistakes. We get a laugh out of, you know, what they're doing in the economy. And that's how we cope. And that's their function, I think, is to help us cope at night and deal with the reality of whatever is happening. But when it becomes this relentless pounding of just night after night after night, and you can't like just come up for air for something else, you know, there's nothing else that's funny that's going on in the country right now, you know, nothing else. Yeah.
That is it for this episode of the Outrage Overload podcast. For links to everything we talked about on this episode, go to outrageoverload.net. Before you leave, let me tell you about our Facebook group. Join in to connect with like-minded listeners, discuss the show, and shape its future. Share your thoughts on outrages, give us feedback, suggest guests, and be part of a growing community. Visit outrageoverload.net/join. And contact me on Twitter or Instagram, at Mr. Blog, and just say hi. Thanks for listening, and remember, together we can lower the temperature.